Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast for Wednesday, September 30th. I'm Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News, and I'm joined in the studio, as always, by Christopher Wynn.
Christopher
is the deputy editor for FD, the style magazine of the Dallas Morning News, and also joining us, as always, is the great Lauren Smart.
Yes, yeah. Smart.
She's the arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer. How are you guys doing?
Let's just never get old.
Yeah, right.
that's why we use them.
I'm great. Thank you for asking.
And Chris, yeah. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Awesome. I, too, am doing pretty well.
We weren't going to ask.
Well, I know. That's why I said it. On today's show, we talk with author and SMU film professor Sean Griffin about the current wave of LGBT stories and characters in the movies. Next, the Dallas Contemporary's Justine Ludwig talks about her curatorial mission to add heat and international relevance to Dallas's art scene. Finally, we consider how guys use sports talk as a social safety net. How about those Rangers? 2.5 up now.
I was at the game last night.
Were you really?
Yeah. Well, for
You've got
five
some street
innings.
Cred.
You just totally scoreboarded us on our sports thing. But first, C-Dub has some important administrative details to attend to.
That's right. I don't know how important they are, but it's National Podcast Day.
Some trivial administrative details.
Is that a real holiday?
It's a real thing. Today is, in fact, September 30th is International Podcast Day.
Who decided this?
I don't know.
Christopher did.
Yeah. It just became a hashtag. Right. It began circulating around, so I'm jumping on it. But I thought it was a good time to share a listener text message that we've got from a listener named Joshua. And I know him, but I didn't know he listened to the show. And he said, and he is our first binge listener.
Wow.
He says, quote, "I have been binge listening to the podcast over the last couple of days while doing some work on the house."
Sorry, Joshua.
So we're background. Really enjoying it. You guys are doing a great job. So,
yeah. Thanks, Joshua.
Tell some friends. Yeah. Some rich friends.
Yeah, preferably. So thank you, Josh, for binge listening. Also, a public service announcement for our listeners. Next week, Dealey Plaza will be shut down.
That's right.
Because Warner Brothers is coming to town. They are shooting some scenes for the film 11/22/63. So it's a made-for-Hulu TV miniseries based on the Stephen King novel.
Starring James Franco,
yes.
Right?
You buried the lead. James Franco,
James Franco.
In Dallas.
We will have a parade of shirtless selfies by James Franco in Dallas while shooting the scene. And the thing that got my attention today was they sent an email out around the morning news warning us about blank shotgun fires that, you know, that we will hear.
Don't be alarmed.
Yeah, so don't freak out. Don't panic.
Duck and cover.
Yeah. So anyway, they'll be shutting down, I think it's October 7th, 8th, next
yeah,
week.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, so get ready, listeners.
You think maybe James Franco would cut his arm off if we asked him to?
Or do you think he
For
wants
you,
to be...
For you, Chris?
Do you think he wants to be on our podcast? He can be shirtless.
That's not a bad idea, actually.
Yeah, maybe we'll reach... James, if you're listening, and even if you're not, we'll reach out to
this
you.
This is how we make such decisions. I'll bet he'd be game. But right now, let's get this one started.
We cut the legs off of our pants.
Sean Griffin is professor of film and media arts at SMU. He received his PhD from the University of Southern California in 1997. His dissertation became the book Tinkerbells and Evil Queens, The Walt Disney Company from the Inside Out, examining the relationships between Disney and gay culture. He is also the co-author of Queer Images, A History of Lesbian and Gay Film in America. He's currently finishing a history of the American film musical, tentatively,
easy
that's
for you
a
to say.
Bad radio word, tentatively titled Free and Easy. Before becoming a professor, Griffin helped produce television ad campaigns for Disney and Touchstone Motion Pictures, including Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Dead Poets Society, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, The Little Mermaid, Pretty Woman, Dick Tracy, and Beauty and the Beast. Sean, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we're seeing a lot of LGBT movies and stories and characters and themes.
Yes, we are.
Is this something new? Or are we experiencing this in any kind of new way?
I don't think it's something that's where there's been a drought before. If you look back to last year, you know, the theory of everything, you know, that there were movies. It's usually around this time of the year, Oscar time, that one of the things that's changed over the past generation, starting with, I would say, Brokeback Mountain sort of like helped break the dam, so to speak.
I just can't quit you.
Yeah. is that there used to be the sense in Hollywood and agents and managers saying, you know, telling actors not to play gay or lesbian roles because then they'd be typecast and they wouldn't be get hired again. And that's not really the case anymore. Now it's play gay or lesbian or transgender and get your Oscar nomination. So usually around October, suddenly all the gay movies seem to come out of the woodwork. And that's where we're at right now with The Danish Girl and Freeheld coming out right now.
You were telling me, we talked already this week for a story I'm writing about this on Sunday, and you were saying that the transgender community is really where we're seeing the most advances and changes as far as this goes.
Right. That's one of the new, whatever, wrinkles, I guess, to this next generation of movies and TV shows and streaming video series as well that are going on, is that LGBT has been an acronym for, you know, over a decade now, but suddenly the T part of that acronym is getting a lot more attention. I think it's the cutting edge, I guess, or the new hot button topic.
Is the thing where just being gay isn't sensational or interesting enough?
On a certain level, yeah. It's you know, it's a sign of the success of the lesbian, gay, equal rights, you know, civil rights movement. That now that there are, you know, it is, you can be out in the military. Now you can legitimately get married in the United States and a number of other countries across the world, that lesbian, gay is not as edgy, I guess, right, or at least the way it's being presented.
That's such a funny Hollywood idea too. Like, oh, it's not enough just to have the gay character now. It's like, let's go transgender. What's the next?
Right. The odd thing though is that in order to be the sort of like, oh, lesbian and gay is boring, been there, done that, Ellen, you know, all that sort of stuff, is that the normalizing process has meant focusing very much on white middle class lesbian and gay men who want to get married in the conventional manner and have their 2.2 kids in the suburbs, and not dealing with the range of what it means to be queer. So it's, you know, mainstreaming, assimilating, and that's where transgender is sort of like pushing things and not focusing on the raft of stuff. It's no longer people like, you know, with you know, earrings and mohawks and, you know, Doc Martens,
right,
that are, you know, making up their own rules about what sexuality is. It's, you know,
it's Neil Patrick Harris and his boyfriend and their cute kids.
Right,
and Oprah's coming over for an interview.
And the Home and Garden layout. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
So
it seems too, though, like some of the shows and movies are tackling these issues in really specific ways. Like, I think of like Transparent and the open way they talk about sexuality and just the act of having sex with someone who's gay or trans or...
Right. One of the things I think that's as part of the sort of like, you know, of that lesbian or gay or whatever is sort of, you know, been there, done that, transgender is the new edgy material, is that the people that are pushing that are usually people that are trying to get attention for their, so there's more attention to transgender topics in independent film or streaming video. So Netflix with Orange is the New Black, or like you said with Transparent, so that they're the ones that seem to be, because they're trying to make inroads and get people sort of like, look, you can only get this if you subscribe to our service happening. So it's edgy on two fronts, both edgy in terms of like, here's this new content provider as well as new subject material.
So the mainstreaming that we were talking about, there's been some backlash against that. I'm thinking particularly of Stonewall, which just isn't a very good movie.
Yeah, the movie Stonewall.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
The recent movie version of Stonewall.
Thank you for clarifying.
It's not the 1990s version of Stonewall.
Which has been so panned, I'm afraid to even see it.
It's been panned by everybody, but there have been very vocal complaints, especially from the transgender community, saying that, you know, everything from not casting trans actors to downplaying the role of trans characters in favor of this, you know, this pretty white guy from the Midwest.
Yeah, drag queens, transgender people, and lesbians were right at the forefront of that historical moment. Not young white boys; they were not the ones that dominated that specific bar in Greenwich Village. So, yes, the idea of, you know, here, somebody of color will hand the white lead character the brick to throw to start the riot is not really the same thing.
Right. Yeah.
I was wondering what might be another good example of a movement that becomes the forefront in American conversation that also had its day in Hollywood. I mean, was there, in when the civil rights movement was happening for Black America, were there movies being made
talking
about that?
It's interesting. As new civil rights movements come, the sort of like window of where there's still hot topics or dealing with them gets shorter and shorter. So you can talk, you know, decades of trying to get somewhere near to equitable representation of African Americans on television and in motion pictures. I think we're just at the point where there's enough, you know, there's still, you know, in terms of showing a wide range of African-American characters, African-American characters as lead characters and number of stars that can, you know, jumpstart their own productions. But that's relatively recent within our lifetimes that's happened. That the gay and lesbian, you know, movement in terms of trying to get represented, I'd say somewhere around the late 70s, early 80s through till, you know, within the past 5-10 years. So much shorter time frame. And I have a feeling that the transgender, now that people are sort of like, wow, yeah, these people have not been given, you know, their due and are still being misunderstood and oppressed. And, you know, that even lesbian and gay, a number of lesbian and gay people need to be educated more about the difference between cisgender and transgender people, of that this is the new moment to sort of like really try and start focusing attention on their lives and their experiences. I have a feeling that's going to not take as long as it did for, you know, African Americans or for lesbian or gay characters.
Sean, you point out in Queer Images, the book that you co-wrote with Harry Benshoff.
Yes, that's my husband, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, there you go.
Shout out. He's a professor at UNT.
I was going to leave you to say that.
Okay.
How long have you guys been together?
As we were walking out, he was like, you better mention my name on this podcast. So,
What's up, Harry?
We've been together for just over 22 years, and we got married in Massachusetts right when it became legal, because it was right around when our anniversary.
Awesome.
Yes, thank you.
So you guys point out that there has long been an independent scene for queer cinema, especially with people like Todd Haynes, for instance. So that's definitely not anything. In fact, Todd Haynes has a new film coming out in this season called Carol, which looks fantastic.
Yes, definitely. There was a explosion of independent cinema in the early 90s that people started dubbing new queer cinema, that came out of the growth of independent cinema in the 80s. So the same era that gave birth to Quentin Tarantino gave birth to people like Gus Van Sant and Todd Haynes. So there is a heritage of that. But those early movies from the 90s, by being independent, were very specifically the use of the term queer, of it's not either or, you're either heterosexual or you're homosexual. It was constantly blurring the boundaries of what sexuality is instead of being fit into an easy category. Modern Family isn't queer. Modern Family is gay friendly, but it's not queer. The transgender stuff, I think, is kind of a return to that sort of, like, you know, of really calling into question a lot of things that people have taken for granted for all sides. Like I said, you know, not just heterosexual people, but all the number of lesbians and gay men also coming to terms with those things. Because of that, I think there are some worries about stereotyping, of like falling into easy categorization. One of the things that you see a lot in terms of how transgender characters are portrayed is they're asexual.
Right.
That they show them at the kind of, it's falling into the supporting character, best friend, you know, comrade, and just getting used to understanding who they are as an individual and not asking any questions about, okay, how do you have sex? That's still an issue that needs to be left alone, that still needs to be broached in the future.
And because presumably that makes them more palatable for the mainstream audience, or, you know, they're safer.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same way lesbian and gay people characters were in the early, about 20 years ago, 20, 30 years ago, where it was, okay, you can be the best friend. We don't want to actually have to deal with you actually going out or kissing somebody.
Right.
So,
What's, you know, I'm curious, where does it go from here? If the capital T in LGBT mm-hmm. is kind of having its moment, you know, mm-hmm. what is the next step?
Well, I mean, you know, I get out my queer crystal ball.
Yes, yes. Look into the future, Sean.
Yes. On a certain level, you know, I can see one of the things that's gone on with lesbian gay thing is knowing how to market them, of treating lesbian gay people not as a political movement, but as a consumer market. That so many of the actual, you know, not so many, but a number of people that have come out as transgender have been tied to being models. And so I can see, you know, some way of sort of like, look here, it's the new trans, you know, sort of like the new version of lesbian chic from the 90s,
right.
90s mm-hmm. of like it's transgender chic. I could see that possibly as a way of bringing it back in and making it, you know, palatable. One of the things that I find interesting that has happened since Harry and I wrote the book Queer Images, right as we were publishing that is when Web 2.0 exploded. And so much of that book talks about who owns the means of production and, you know, who's able to make a motion picture, who's able to get a television series on the air, that since that point, you know, the means of production is pretty easily available, he says on a podcast.
right.
And so people, you know, people that feel like they're not being represented or their stories or experiences are not being told are able to get out there, posting stuff out on YouTube or on Twitter or on Tumblr.
Kind of like Tangerine, as we saw the iPhone movie. You
know? Yes, yeah. And Tangerine is great.
It is.
Yeah.
Top 10 for me, probably.
It's amazing, amazing, mm-hmm. amazing film, and does a really great job of talking about transgender issues without making a big deal about being transgender, talking about sexuality, showing people of color and working class people instead of the, here I am in, you know, the suburbs of North Hollywood in my split level.
Right.
So it was really wonderful.
Something like Tangerine would fit more into the queer cinema tradition rather than just the gay friendly.
Yes. Trend. Yes. Tangerine is definitely in the mode, in the spirit of the classic new queer cinema of the 1990s. Definitely do it yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about your book about movie musicals.
Okay.
I just am curious what got you into. I have long abhorred the movie musical.
Really?
Oh my god!
I'm sitting in a room with you, and you're saying that?
No, just because.
Why? To see.
Well, I grew up going to the theater, and I've always felt it doesn't necessarily. There are some that are good, but it usually doesn't transfer into a film well. But I'm curious, why you got interested in movie musicals and are writing a book
about. Well, you know, the horrible cliche thing is, well, I'm gay.
Hello.
My first sort of like real love of movies, where I sort of like was really like, oh my god, I can't wait, I want to know everything about this, was Disney.
Yeah, okay.
And so, you know, so many of the cartoons are
musical. But you're right. That's so right.
Okay. They're singing when they're supposed to be talking.
Yeah, you're
so
right.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
I'm thinking like Oklahoma, the one, the classic
right,
one.
Yes, yes.
Seven Brothers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Disney has kind of kept the genre alive over the past whatever couple decades with stuff like Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast, and even into doing stuff like High School Musical and Newsies, and you know they've taken over Broadway. So you know they, I guess that was my whatever entrance point to that, and then
that was your gateway.
yeah and I don't know, I guess what I like about musicals is the transformative feeling, and it's one of the things that I'm trying to continually sort of like, you know, balance throughout the book that I'm writing, is that a lot of people talk about Westerns as being this sort of like balance between the frontier and civilization, of, you know, always being on the cusp of that and trying to figure it out. So the lone man comes in and, you know, brings civilization, but then he rides off. He's not part of it, but he supports it. That musicals are often about the celebration of being able to be totally free to do whatever you want, to sing when you should be talking, to dance on the ceiling, to, you know, and do it perfectly. And yet it's also about sort of like bonding, finding other people that you can share that with and enjoy that with. Something about that really appeals to me, because I guess word has gotten out that I sing in my classes.
We've heard
rumors. Yes, he was telling me, taking me up the elevator and going like, yeah, you're going to sing something. I'm like, what?
Surprise!
Yeah.
Sean, can you give us a couple of notes of something in particular that you love?
I can save it for the end of the podcast. I have an idea of something to sing for.
Awesome. Oh, goody! Right. Oh, goody! Keep us in suspense.
Yes, exactly.
I worked
in marketing at Disney, so I know how to
build the tease.
Yes.
Yeah. Lauren Smart, have you seen the Singing in the Rain?
Yes, I have. No, I'm not saying I hate all of them. Yes. You just
don't like a lot of them.
I just would rather.
What's your deal?
You said you like certain musicals, but you don't think they don't transfer very well into film.
Right. So, for example, Rent into the Woods. I saw a lot. Growing up, we watched musicals on television all the time.
Rent's just not a great movie.
Yeah.
No, right. But that, I think part of that is there's a magic to seeing the rock musical on stage that you can't capture in a movie. I mean, could someone else have done it better? Maybe. But I felt kind of the same way with Into the Woods when I saw it this year.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, whenever you're adapting something that's been originally done for a different medium, trying to figure out how to adapt. So Into the Woods as a play takes very much advantage of the fact that there's an intermission.
Right.
And unless they were going to do some big, huge roadshow version of Into the Woods where there would be an intermission, they had to figure out their way around that. And I don't think they did a great job, but I don't know if anybody could have come up with an answer to that.
Singing in the Rain is a good example of a good movie musical.
And it's pure, it's cinema.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's not something that was taken from the stage. Right. And
Hello, Dolly, some of those. Yeah.
Yeah, that's my favorite movie of all time, Singing in the Rain. Because it's a musical that's about making movies. So, of course, that would be my favorite movie
of all time.
Meta. Yes. Meta before anybody was using that term.
So, Sean, you are going to stick around and sing for us.
/sing.
Awesome. Yes. In the meantime, you can keep up with Sean Griffin on Twitter. His Twitter handle is Singing Film Prof, which is perfect. And now you know why. Sean, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for inviting me.
Is that Sound and Vision? That's like the second time we've used Sound and Vision.
We loved it so much last time. This is actually a remix of it, kind of a cover version and remix.
But we're not talking about Sound and Vision. We're talking about Justine Ludwig. She arrived in Dallas a year ago from Cincinnati. Her career has included positions in museums throughout the country. She has an MA in Global Arts from Goldsmiths, University of London, where my girlfriend went to school. I'll have you know. So she'll be very happy listening to this show.
Go Kate.
Go Kate. Currently, she is the director of exhibitions and senior curator at the Dallas Contemporary, where she recently unveiled the first round of programming she's ever seen, composed of 5 concurrent exhibitions. Wow, that sounds hard. Justine, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So I know that you just got back from Art Prize in Grand Rapids, and since it's coming here next year, I wanted to know if you would tell us a little bit about what it's like to be at Art Prize.
Yeah, of course. I'm still reeling from it a little bit. I got back last night, so I'm in that headspace, really, so I'm glad to talk about it. It was an amazing experience because it's this art competition that takes over really the entire city. So it's in the museums, it's in the convention center, it's in little coffee shops, stores, dive bars, everywhere. So it's this unbelievable thing where you have throngs of people walking through all these different venues and looking at art. And everybody has the opportunity to vote on what they think is the best work of art. And then you have a group of jurors, I was one of them, and we get to select what we think is the best work of art. So it's an interesting conversation between the power of the public and the power of experts, as they decided
the
to call
quote unquote
us.
Experts.
Yes, there were air quotes there.
Those people.
Yes.
So, I mean, how many works of art do you think that you saw in the span of, you were there, what, 4 days, 5 days?
I was there about 3 days.
Okay.
And I saw hundreds upon hundreds of works of art. It was crazy.
That is insane.
Did you see anything that just made you shake your head and say, you know, no?
Well, yes, there are always those moments, but that is also something quite liberating in a way. It made me recalibrate my brain a little bit to see, you know, very famous artists next to Sunday painters, and that was something that was exciting and, for me, an opportunity I never get. So it was really wonderful.
So when I go to a film festival and I see 4 or 5 movies in a day, I'm exhausted and I like temporarily hate movies for a couple of hours. Do you overload at something like this?
Yeah, you do overload a little bit. I basically couldn't sleep the entire time I was there. I would just sit up in bed thinking about everything I saw.
You're so visually stimulated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was very overwhelming, but being part of the art world, it is something that you're accustomed to. When you go to art fairs, when you go to Biennales, you take in an insane amount of art that you can't even process in the time that you actually see them. So we use, you know, cell phones, notes, a lot of things to help us to form a memory outside of just that one moment when we're actually looking at the pieces.
And did you, I mean, was it easy to narrow it down to your favorites, or was it really hard?
It was really hard.
Yeah.
So I had to come up with a system through which to do that, because there were some pieces that I saw initially, I thought they were amazing. They blew my mind through either what they were saying or technical skill, but they didn't stick with me. So I excluded those from the list that I looked at the end. It was really the pieces that came back to me over and over again that I included in my final list, because I had to narrow it down to 5. And I was the juror for 2D art, which really runs the range. So I was looking at quilting, photography, printmaking, drawing, a lot of very, very different things. It's hard to compare them.
Yeah, I imagine.
So, Justine, you'd mentioned earlier you'll see pieces by someone who is very accomplished next to something by the quote-unquote Sunday painter. And in a way, that is at the heart of what has made Art Prize a little, I don't know if controversial is the right word, but it's coming to Dallas next year, Art Prize Dallas. And there's been kind of a big divide around it. Some people are like, this is the most amazing thing that's happened to Dallas, and it's an incredible opportunity to be part of this huge thing, and it's the people get to vote on the art and so forth. And that's exactly what scares kind of the establishment, I guess, you know, who wants to kind of retain that quality control of the art that we all look at and welcome into the city. And I wonder if you could kind of talk about that.
And could you also maybe just say what Art Prize is for people who don't know, who aren't quite as aware of what this thing is we're discussing?
We'll get to the contemporary in a minute.
Yeah, we're just going to talk about Art Prize. Well, Art Prize is this citywide art competition that anybody can enter, and your work will be shown, and it doesn't matter what your background is. It just matters that you are making art. And then there's a public vote. And if you win the public vote, you will win $200,000. And if you win the jury vote, you will win $200,000. So it is pretty much the biggest art prize that is out there, which is also an unbelievable thing. And there's nothing like it. Completely.
And I'm sorry, Christopher Wynn. What was your question again?
Well, and that's what has made it a little bit of a buzzy talking point with Art Prize coming to Dallas. And I just wonder what you think about that.
I think when it comes to Dallas, it's going to have to be a very different thing from what it is in Grand Rapids. And from talking to the people who are bringing it here, the intention is to tailor it to Dallas, because Art Prize Grand Rapids is for the community in Grand Rapids, for the community in Michigan, and they're speaking to that audience specifically. And Dallas is a very different city with its own unique culture, so it's going to probably not be the exact same thing as what we see there. But the core of it, which is the ability that everybody can show their work and everybody has a say in what wins, is something that I believe will stay. It's something that is quite magical about it. I was running all around the city, and people that I didn't know, who didn't know me, would come up to me and just start talking about the work of art in front of them and tell me why they thought it was important, not knowing that I was one of the jurors. Mm-hmm. And that was something amazing, because I feel like I'm so often separated from the art audience. And that frustrates me a lot. I want to know what people value. I want to know what people care about and why. And so that was amazing. And I think it is important to turn over the sort of power of the expert and say that the audience's view is valid and their opinions are valid. And that will lead to greater engagement, people feeling like they have more right to have an opinion on what good art is. And I'm completely comfortable with that. I want to have to defend why I think something is good. Mm-hmm. I think the idea that just because a work of art is in a museum, it's good, is ridiculous. So I like the idea that it brings about more conversation, certain openness in terms of how we judge what good art is.
Hmm. Now to the contemporary.
To the contemporary.
Oh, that's right.
So you got here about a year ago, and when you got your feet on the ground, what did you want programming at the Contemporary to look like? What was sort of your first mission?
Well, I wanted it to really follow what the institution's mission statement is, which is to show local, national, and international art that challenges and expands the mind of those that look at the work. And so I wanted to bring and invest in programming that does that, and also that brings really a diversity of voices to the institution so that you see what the range of contemporary visual practices, be that design, be that painting, installation, performance. I really wanted to invest in the range of what contemporary art can be. And that's what I see us doing moving forward, and something that I'm really excited about. I primarily work with female artists. A lot of them are international, but I've also, throughout my career, been very invested in local arts communities. I was seduced by the amazing talent of local artists here and am unbelievably excited about the opportunities to work with them within the institution, right next to internationally respected, renowned artists. And that's something that we're investing in moving forward.
And of the five exhibits at the Contemporary right now, you curated two of the exhibits. I wonder if you could talk about a little, I mean, they're very different exhibits too. Talk about a little bit about the two artists who you've worked with.
Well, they're two artists I've wanted to work with for a really long time. And I think that they take very different approaches to what contemporary art should be. We have Bani Abadi, who is a video artist from Pakistan, and all her work is very geospecific. Everything she does is based in her hometown, which is Karachi. And she created for us an immersive video installation, and we commissioned a new film from her.
Yeah, being in the room with her videos is like, it's very overwhelming because you start to, I think your mind kind of gets displaced a little bit. You forget you're at the Contemporary. And you're looking around and you're indifferent. It looks like you're on the beach 1 minute and you're in a, you know, there's a part where people are stacking books in one video. It's really, really wonderful.
Thank you. And that's what the intent was, to sort of transport you and bring you into different places. And she's looking at issues like national identity, ethnicity, and very difficult subject matter that is specific to Karachi in terms of how she's looking at it, but these are international issues that we deal with even here in Dallas. And so I thought it was interesting to bring her perspective from Pakistan to the Contemporary.
And the other exhibit you curated is very different, though.
Yes.
So talk to us a little bit about Nadia.
Yes.
I'm going to screw up her last name, so I'll let you say it.
Nadia Kabelenke. She's a Tunisian-Russian artist that works in every different manner you could imagine. She thinks of an idea and then figures out how it could best be expressed. And the line that you see through her work is that she's interested in the visualization of trauma, primarily. And she employs beauty as a way of addressing that, which I think is an interesting proposition, saying that I can address very difficult subject matter that people don't want to talk about if I use beauty as an entry point. And so far we've seen that.
Which is brilliant.
Yes. Yeah. And so far we've seen it to work, because one of her projects addresses domestic violence, which is not something that people feel comfortable talking about. But in the context of this exhibition, I've heard families have conversations about that. Another one, she deals with how people are still dealing with World War II and the Berlin Wall within Berlin, which is where she calls home now. And people have been talking about that, too.
Describe that piece to us, though, because that piece is really beautiful.
So that piece, it's titled The Altarpiece, and it is a wall rubbing taken from the building that now houses the Boros Collection in the center of Berlin. It's a huge building that people walk by on a daily basis. And it was originally a Nazi bunker, and it's been torn apart by warfare within the center of the city. But that trauma that is really scarred the building is something people have ceased to notice. They pretend it's not there. So she took a wall rubbing of part of that building and then encased it in a gold triptych reminiscent of what an early Christian altarpiece would be. And it's something that you can open and close. So when you close it, it's this perfect golden square, but when you open it, you see the surface of the building. She's talking about how shocked she was living in Berlin, where people pretend that the history of the city simply did not happen. And she's always having this fear that not addressing this issue, simply covering it up and moving on and saying everything is fine, is actually a really bad way of dealing with trauma. And if there was an openness through which we could discuss this, we could actually move on from the societal trauma. And so that's what she's looking at in the piece.
It's interesting. A lot of people say the same thing about storytelling. Mm-hmm. If you tell stories or you write stories about traumas that are happened to you or happened elsewhere on a larger level. It's a way of perhaps purging and healing these horrible things.
Yeah, and it's exactly in that spirit that she's creating art.
I want to ask you about a piece that you did in this month's FD magazine. You're also a freelance writer as well, among your duties. And you wrote about Arthur Pina, a local Dallas artist. All the various disclosures, I'm a deputy editor at FD. I was not the assigning editor on this particular piece. Art also is Lauren Smart's significant other. So all disclosures out there.
I have absolutely nothing to do with Arthur Pena.
Chris, what's your time?
I feel like you probably met him.
I've met him.
Maybe at a grocery store.
Yeah, I met him once. Yeah, I think I met him with you at Whole Foods, actually. Hey, Art, what's going on, man?
Yeah. You have there was a really beautiful moment in the story that I loved. I wanted to ask you about because I think it kind of gets to the heart of what we're talking about a little bit, where you talk about Art being 8 years old and going on a school trip to the DMA and looking at a Mark Rothko painting. And when one of the teachers, was it Orange? I actually wrote, Orange, Red, and Red. And one of the teachers asked him what he thought about it. And his reply was, "I don't know, but I feel sad." And I love that because that's what art is about, what you're feeling. And I just wonder if you could talk some more about that moment and art and Art Pina.
Well, I think that's one way that Arthur and I really have connected through conversations, that we both believe that art is unbelievably powerful, that it can make people feel or be open in a way that they are not accustomed to. And it can create the sort of liminal space through which we can either deal with our own trauma or things that we see in society that we want to change or find to be difficult. So when he was telling me that story, it's something that I felt time and time again, explaining the pieces at Art Prize that I picked for the top five, it was the pieces that made me really feel something. That wasn't just, oh, what a lovely painting. It was, wow, this is making me think. I didn't always know what it was that it made me feel, but it was something very, very strong.
And beyond just, it's technically, it's executed well. It's like it makes me feel. Yeah.
Yes, and it's saying something and it's speaking to me on a deeper level. And that's what I see the power of art to be, and Arthur clearly sees that as well. And something that I really am drawn to about his work is the fact that he finds these moments within the work that he creates as well as when he discusses the work of others.
Justine, will you stick around and tout something?
Yes, I would love
us?
To.
Awesome. You can follow Justine on Twitter. She's one of those clever people who uses the last name first. It's Ludwig, at Ludwig Justine, LudwigJustine. Justine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. About sound and vision.
Don't cross them lines. What you like, what I like.
So there's a new FD men's issue out, Christopher. When?
It's a very FD day today.
You guys are always, you guys have like a different special issue out like every day, it seems like.
It feels like it. This is the men's issue. So it's all about men, and we wanted to be different. It's about thinking, feeling men. It's sort of men in a different light.
So I pitched to you a essay about sort of the insanity of the sports fan.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, yeah, that might be interesting. And so then I kind of rejiggered it to talk about how sports talk, just talking about sports, is really important, especially for guys who don't like talking about things to each other, just because it opens up conversation.
And then my little antenna went off.
And your antenna went off, and I got to write this fun essay sort of about the social currency of being a sports fan and how I realized at a certain point in my life that being a sports fan makes absolutely no sense at all, but I'm one anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started just thinking about how sports helped me interact with other members of my gender, especially when we may be reticent to discuss things, and they might lead to talking about things that are important. And so that's what I wrote about, damn it.
Why do you think men have a problem talking to other men?
I don't know. It's a really good question.
One man to another.
Yeah. I can't really talk about that, Christopher, but I'm glad
that's
you
right,
asked.
To my point.
I just, you know, I can answer in sort of broad stereotypes. I think, you know, women characteristically are better at talking about things that matter to them than men are. We have this very sort of stoic exterior, if you will. And sometimes we also have a vacant interior, perhaps.
I have a theory. Can I get?
Yes.
Can I throw my theory out there?
Sarah Lawrence Smart's theory. Lawrence Smart, who went to the Rangers game.
I did go
last
to. I've
night,
been to two Rangers games.
And I haven't
this
been
season.
To any. So you've been
I,
to two
I also
more
bought
Rangers
a jersey at my first Rangers game.
You're such a sports fan.
I'm such a sports fan.
What do you think? Cole Hamels?
Who?
Never mind.
I'm sorry, what?
What? no, but my theory is that men have spent a lot longer, like decades and centuries, building professional personas, sort of like a hardened outer shell. And because of the role that women have played in society for so long, women haven't necessarily built that exterior. And so since women are fairly new still, as weird as that is, to the workforce, they haven't spent as long creating these personas. So I think that part of it is that men aren't as in touch with themselves, aren't really as able, like haven't been trained to be as capable to talk about their feelings. And women have been told throughout history, throughout their lives, we're still raised this way, that we are able and it's normal. It's normalized to talk about our emotions, our lives, our day-to-day struggles with being alive and being human. And men are told, no, you need to get to work and you can't cry and you are this, you're tough guy. And so sports are this sort of language that they can use.
I want to hear from our guests. What do you, yeah. Sean Griffin?
Yeah,
and
I'm curious.
Well, I agree with the general sense that sort of like a patriarchy, sort of like a sense of like how men are trained to behave socially is to be the leaders in charge. And so that means not sharing. It means leading. So you talk at people, not with people. There's a new book out, or a new, I think it's a new essay, pointing out how it's not that this is the way things are currently is not the way things were, say, even 100 years ago, that men felt completely comfortable, you know, hugging each other, embracing each other, talking emotionally with each other. And I think, if anything, it's the as homosexuality has become more prevalent in society, more talked about,
more visible,
that straight men often feel very sign of any sort of bonding that isn't somehow tied to violence, like, you know, you're a great guy, smack you on the shoulder, whatever, you know, type of thing, or I'm going to show how much I love you by wrestling you to the ground, type of thing, that anything that might smack of affection, even unto having to place a chair between each other if two guys go to a movie together, is seen as like, oh my God, everybody's going to think I'm gay. So if anything, these sort of like more openness about homosexuality has had this really effect on heterosexual men of feeling worried that they can't show emotions because that's feminizing, and so it's gotten worse. I think
the urinal too. You got to have a space in the row of urinals.
The urinal drives me crazy. I can't handle that. Well,
and in the same way, like it's sports is sort
of. You guys don't go to sports events because there's troughs. How do you deal with troughs?
I can't handle the trough. And I'm going to get real. There used to be little divider walls here at the morning news, and we did a really bad Home Depot remodel, and the partitions are gone. And it kind of freaks me out.
Nervous,
I'm just going to say it.
Nervous bladder.
Yeah. But I was going to say, I think that sports are also a guarded straight man arena, because women aren't really encouraged to know anything about sports. And the women.
Unless you're in Texas.
Well, but even.
Women in Texas know so much about sports, it's crazy.
That,
I learned that when I moved here.
But even that, even that is, you can go, we'll let you in maybe for a little while, but it's definitely still our thing. And stereotypically, gay men aren't interested in sports, so keeps them out too.
Sports is soap opera for guys.
Yeah,
that's a good way to put it. Justine, what do you think about the Cowboys' chances without Romo?
I'm really not the right person to ask there.
That's why
I'm from Massachusetts too.
Oh, Tom Brady.
It's going to get a bit controversial if I start talking about what I care about.
Deflate gay.
Hey, I teach at SMU.
Yeah.
Pony Express.
Rest in peace.
So in your world, Justine, it's all, is it art? Do you talk, you know, art and artist and things as casually as we all are talking sport? Not we all, not me, but sport. I mean, is it just your crowd, whatever your crowd is kind of crowd determines your currency, your social currency that you talk about?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot there. I mean, a lot of my friends are also huge soccer fans. So around the time the World Cup comes up, that's when we get really serious. But that's not just gender specific. That's something I know a lot of women who are equally into that. Mm-hmm. So, and it's interesting because I always have had more male friends than female friends, and I think they are very emotional with me generally because I am their token female friend. So I see a very different sort of gender dynamic here. There's never sort of another conversation that we're having to hide emotions. It's always a very straightforward.
Can I cry with you after the podcast?
Sure, come on over.
So I'm gonna be pretentious and read from my own essay from the actual hard copy of.
Oh, go print.
Do it in your sport. Do you have a sports voice though?
Sports create a common language. No, I'm not going to do that, actually, but I do have one. So as Chris Wagner writes.
Yes. In, what does that new, Wagner guy say?
The new Who? FD men's issue. Sports create a common language out of thin air, and they provide an excuse to shoot the bull over a subject of little consequence. Let's face it. Aside from the sociological and economic implications that create grist for the wonk mill, sports, as most of us experience them, are inconsequential. They're a welcome distraction. Therein lies their conversational glory. Unlike politics and religion, the subjects you're not supposed to discuss over dinner or with strangers, sports provide a social safe zone. Even if you end up in a room with a Cowboys fan and a Steelers fan, whatever tension ensues will usually come with a healthy dose of camaraderie and debate.
And that's why I often feel left out, because I don't know those references. I'm not into sports, and I have a lot of straight friends, and often I do have that moment where I'm just kind of standing there meekly while they're having this really passionate conversation about people I don't know.
And I kind of I'm one of these people who crosses weird, I guess they're not weird, but I cross lines from sports to theater to film to literature. Basically, I'm a Renaissance man is what I'm
You're an unusual exception. But I will say this, one theory I have is that the cable indie drama has become the new sports thing. It's like, what shows are you watching? Oh, Orange is the New Black. Oh, did you do Breaking Bad? Blah, blah, blah. You know, in a way, that has become, in a lot of circles that I run in, sort of that's replaced sports because everybody's watching some show and you can talk about that.
Yeah, so it's this whole social currency water cooler kind of thing.
Right now it's Donald Trump. For the past few months, all anybody has been like, oh, what do you think about Donald Trump?
Right.
I don't have any opinion.
I have nothing to say.
I don't talk politics.
At the dinner table.
Ever.
Or with strangers. Never?
I want to say,
by the
way.
Don't you have friends that you talk politics with?
No.
Really?
I mean, like,
politics
people
fascinate
I live
me.
With. The person I live with or, like, my, no, not my parents. Yeah, no, don't talk politics.
I love talking politics, but only I'm not a very confrontational person, so I talk politics like within my own tribe.
Yeah, but how do you know?
The
tribes are also getting like super microcosm.
True.
How do you know?
That's part of what makes it interesting.
Are you Bernie or Hillary? Are you Carly or Trump? You never know.
I guess it's a good time to let you guys know I read minds, so I can tell who everybody voted for.
Yeah. Oh.
Good times, I say. Good times.
Men just talk. Yes. Feel. Think.
Yes. Ugh.
Sports.
Me, Wagner.
What just happened?
And I've also heard from women who have, some of my friends who've read this story on Facebook especially, who have pointed out that sports can be a really good subject to address with guys, with guy friends, for instance, perhaps on the path to talking about something of more substance.
Sure. I've had a student who wrote her master's thesis about women who are big fans of watching ESPN. So there is this whole group, especially to me, having moved to Texas, of seeing women who know much more about sports than I do. And I was telling you earlier on that Sports Illustrated, when it debuted in the early 50s, was actually aimed at women as a magazine to try and reach women and explain sports to women.
So literally Sports Illustrated, as in?
Yeah,
like
literally.
Cooks Illustrated.
Yeah, of trying to market sports for a female audience. So it didn't last very long before they switched over into just being a sports magazine, you know, a news magazine for men.
And but, Bikinis Illustrated.
Yeah, and then the swimsuit issue just kind of blew all that to hell. So. You can read my essay about the social currency of sports fandom at fdmag.com. We'll also include a link on our show page at guidelive.com/podcasts. We'll be right back with some touts. It's time to move on to our touts. This is the portion of our show where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, or just plain obsessed with. Let's start with Justine. What do you got?
Gabriella Jauregui's Controlled Decay. It's a book of poetry that I came across a few months ago. It was originally published in 2008. The poet is based in Mexico City, and I have been reading it continuously over and over again. Her poems are amazing, hallucinatory, but yet based in real life issues, and they are stunning.
What's the name again?
Controlled Decay by Gabriella Jauregui.
Gotcha.
That's amazing.
Mr. Nguyen.
I've become obsessed again with the graphic designer Saul Bass, who did, something came on. It's a mad world came on recently, and I just saw the opening sequence with like the animated globe and the hand coming down to open it like a can and all the characters. He famously did a lot of Hitchcock opening title sequences, you know, Psycho, the letters that kind of streak across and break apart.
North by Northwest.
North by Northwest.
Vertigo.
Vertigo, where
fantastic.
You go into the eyeball and then you get into the big spiral. I mean, just an incredible designer, and it made me go in a big YouTube rabbit hole. So Saul Bass, just get your iPad and check out for about an hour.
So just in general.
Just anything Saul Bass. Just
dive in.
Just queue up 10 or 12 of his best opening credit sequences and pour a glass of wine, and we'll talk about it next week.
Awesome.
Lauren?
I am currently obsessed, have been obsessed with for a little while, a local playwright. His name is Brigham Mosley. He and I actually went to school together years ago, but he moved back to Dallas about a year and a half ago after spending about 5 years in New York City. And he writes these plays that they're probably the most progressive theater you'll see in Dallas. He's really interested in the social anxieties of the internet and what it does to the mostly millennial generation. But they're really, really, really smart plays. And he's got a new one that premieres this weekend that's called #Basic. And it's part of House Party Theater, so it's at a random location that I will get Christopher Wynn to post on our page later.
Find it on our show page later.
Yeah. So I think tickets are $10, and it opens Friday and runs through October 19th.
And his name again?
Brigham Mosley.
Awesome. I have the most mainstream tout in the history of our show, it very wholeheartedly. Go see The Walk.
I saw your tweet about that.
See it in 3D IMAX, and you will not regret it, and that's all I'm going to say.
About World Trade Center, that film, right?
Yeah, it's just the last half hour or so is just unlike anything I've ever seen before at the movies, and I found it, I found it profoundly moving as much as anything in a way that I just really was not expecting at all. Kind of like when, the movie Up, the
right
Pixar movie, those 5 minutes at the beginning.
The one I cried my way through.
Just like, why are tears running down my cheeks at this goddamn Pixar movie?
Right.
It's not, quite that dramatic, but I found it to be a very emotional experience and also just an example of pure movie magic. So
wow. So see it on the big screen. Yeah.
Go check it out.
Awesome.
Sean Griffin, you're going to take us out with a song.
You got me really. I already wanted to go see The Walk, and now I'm like dying to see The Walk.
Please do. Please do.
So that's. I'm usually obsessed about things that like I haven't gotten a chance to get to yet, so like the anticipation of stuff. So I'm really excited that they've just released the first 5 seasons of The Carol Burnett Show.
Oh, wow.
That's stuff that they've never shown on all the rerun stuff, so I can't wait to get my
hands. And I saw she went to a party to premiere it, and it's like she's like 80-something and still looks amazing, and yeah.
That's Hollywood.
I don't know how much that cost her. But
yes, exactly. And I'll just leave it at that. And that's a good segue into sort of like what I've decided to sort of like, okay, sing to as an exit out. But I can't do it with the cans on my ears. I can't do it the way Carol does. So, but I'm so glad we had this time together just to have a laugh and sing a song. Seems we just got started, and before you know it, comes the time we have to say so long.
Yay!
That might be the greatest moment in mixed media history right there.
I love that.
Thank you,
beautiful.
Sean. You'll find links.
Makes me tear up.
You'll find, yes, absolutely.
Oh, goodness. Oh, we have to start talking about sports now.
All right.
Talk about sports.
Yeah. Hey, bro. How about those Rangers? Yeah.
Rangers up 2.5 with 5 games left. It's going to be tricky, but we'll see what happens. You can find links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com/podcasts. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com or send us a tweet at mixedmediapod. Please subscribe to our show on iTunes, we beg of you.
It
really does sound like we're pleading with you to subscribe to our show on iTunes.
It's International Podcast Day. Just do it now.
Yeah,
do it,
man. Now. If not now, then when? And leave us a review. Just search for our name, Mixed Media Pod. Today's Mixed Media was engineered by Brian Elledge and produced by Christopher Wynn. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode. Until then, for Christopher Wynn, Lauren Smart, and our two wonderful guests, I am Chris Wagner. And we'll see you next week.